Are we allowed to disagree? That's my question. And before I begin to answer it in this talk I entitled Civility, Pluralism, and Public Reason, I want to thank my one-time colleague and longtime friend Bill Campbell for the opportunity to speak here today and to thank you for coming to listen. Okay, are we allowed to disagree? Well, you might ask, is who allowed to disagree and allowed by whom and about what? If husband and wife allow themselves to disagree about who is sleeping with whom this evening, chances are the marriage is not going to last very long. Same thing if partners disagree about the direction of their firm, or co-authors about what to write. If clergy in the same church disagree on a fundamental point of doctrine, they're headed towards schism. But if they differ in their pastoral advice or in the aesthetics of worship, we accept their differences as a natural consequence of independent judgment. If faculty disagree about the value of learning, then their school is in trouble. But if they disagree about curriculum or about how the books they teach in common ought to be interpreted, that can be, on the contrary, a sign of vitality. How is it then with fellow citizens? Not to permit disagreement among them is the mark of totalitarianism. And such is the nature of man, says Publius, that the seeds of faction, of disagreement, are sown within it. Differences of interest, the fallibility of reason, the variability of opinion, and the interrelation of these ensures disagreement, even when we profess to want harmony or bipartisanship. And since political disagreements are not academic, but have real or immediate consequences for law and public policy, they can be frustrating or annoying, especially, though not only, when we find ourselves on the losing side. I dismissed totalitarianism a moment ago, but that's too easy. For the totalitarian states of the 20th century were one-party states, and one must be a distant observer of partisan behavior not to see in each party a wish to obliterate its opponents, that is, to eliminate through triumph the disagreement between them. What makes opposing partisans fellow citizens? Can't one be a citizen without becoming a partisan? Well, perhaps, but not if one really gets engaged in a campaign or a cause. Again, is there nothing on which all citizens have to agree, or nothing more than to agree to disagree? Now, classical political philosophy, and even more so the classical city, held that a certain fundamental agreement among the citizens was necessary, indeed was constitutive of the city itself. An empire, for example, that of Cyrus, might encompass Persian and Mede, Jew and Greek, provided they didn't take up arms against the emperor and paid their share of the tribute, he could let them live under their own laws, that is, could tolerate a pluralism of laws and faiths. But a self-governing city, or polity or republic to the classics, demanded like-mindedness of its citizens, civic religion, civic education, civic festivals, and the like. When Socrates was accused in Athens of corrupting the young and not believing in the gods of the city, he does not defend himself by saying that the city needs no gods or that corruption is in the eye of the beholder. He argues instead that he believes in the divine and that his practice of questioning his fellow citizens shows he cares about their virtue. Aristotle writes that a city is an association or community in the perception of the advantageous and harmful, the just and unjust. A city deliberates about means to be chosen, says Aristotle, but not about its ends. These are implicit or explicit in its constitution or regime. In medieval monarchies, heresy was a crime not because it jeopardized a man's own salvation, so did sin or lack of faith, but because it threatened the agreement or homonoia, like-mindedness, on which the polity and its law was thought to depend. Now, what I want to say is that what makes American constitutionalism revolutionary from the start, what led the founders to proclaim on the Great Seal, a Novus Ordo Seclorum, a new order of the ages, was they're establishing a republic that did not rest upon orthodoxy, but instead began with freedom of conscience. In other words, they not only knew that fellow citizens in a free country would disagree about policies and personalities, about what laws to make and what taxes to impose, they accepted as well deep and fundamental differences or disagreements about first principles. This was apparent most obviously in the practice of religious toleration. There was to be no religious test for federal office, and then no establishment of religion. So Presbyterian and Methodist, Puritan and Catholic, Episcopalian and Jew, Quaker and Lutheran were all permitted, and in some expressions of this toleration, Muslims were included too, and non-believers. Oaths were allowed, and indeed required in the Constitution for the holding of office. So it's not as though the founders thought their law needed no grounding beyond human willfulness. But in permitting the form of affirmation as an alternative to the oath, they made clear that one's deepest allegiances or reasons were a matter of individual conscience, not something to be imposed by government, at least at the national level. The plurality of opinions had beneath it a pluralism of fundamental commitments. And that fundamental pluralism was something government had to respect, not forcibly establish or suppress. Well, what then do Americans have in common? Or what are they meant to have in common? Our Constitution and our constitutionalism, I want to say. Certain basic rights, privileges and immunities, the institutions of representative government and the rule of law, and the principles that animate and explain these, principally those sketched out in the Declaration of Independence. This is no small neighborhood of common value. The institutional framework alone is complex, organized as it is by the principles of the separation of power and federalism, separation of powers and federalism. And the array of privileges and immunities is extensive, too, especially if it is taken to include, as it surely does, the rights of property, not only of expression. But it is not a comprehensive creed, this declaration. It is both less and more than a Calhounian mechanism to solder together consensus in the context of pluralism. Less because it does not claim to produce unanimity or to conquer friction. More because it includes a few foundational political principles, such as natural equality, God-given rights, and government by consent, that Americans need to share whatever else they share, as Mr. Lincoln understood. What I mean to say is that the self-evidence of these principles is rhetorical rather than strictly philosophical, probable, not proven without debate, and that they are not self-evidently all one needs to know the common good, much less to live well. All Americans can agree that Congress makes our federal laws and that all men are created equal with certain inalienable rights, even though we differ vehemently over what laws ought to be made and over whether that equality is grounded in, say, Lockean liberalism or Catholic natural law or evangelical dispensation or some other bedrock or anchor. Now, let me make a few comments or observations about this position I've just tried to articulate. First, I'm not saying that fundamental disagreements don't influence how we see the Constitution and constitutionalism and what we have in common. I think, in fact, it would be an interesting study of constitutional history and constitutional development to see the way in which different groups in American history, different sort of subcultures in America, have brought their witness to bear on some aspect or another of our constitutionalism and of our constitutional change. Secondly, I'm not saying that this pluralism is fixed or grounded in some kind of Nietzschean relativism, if that makes sense. On the contrary, I think to the American framers, and still today, it's always in flux. We're allowed to try to convert one another, even as we respect one another. And it's only natural that every party, and more than that, every culture or faith, seeks to gain others to its side, maybe to even universalize itself. There's some paradox, I suppose, in that. We respect the disagreement of our political opponents as we respect the commitments of those who don't share our faith or our philosophy. But that doesn't mean we don't try to win over our opponents or persuade those who differ on the more fundamental things. Even if we don't expect that logos is usually going to have too much effect, except to sort of confuse our opponents and solidify our fellow partisans in any actual political debate, and thereby change the question of who's ahead and who's confident at the moment. I'm also not saying, here's the third point, I'm not saying that these more fundamental things are entirely off limits in political speech. Here I think, without blaming this on him, I think what I'm saying is consistent with Jim Caesar's arguments about the role of statesmen in relation to political foundations and the establishment of political foundations, about bringing to bear at different times and for different purposes, alternative groundings of political principle. But I do think, as a final consequence of this view I'm laying out, that it does explain how America can be at once tolerant of enormous diversity, but not completely or infinitely tolerant. For there are some fundamental positions from which one cannot, in good conscience, accept the Constitution or the principles of the Declaration of Independence. I think a Catholic can, a Protestant can, a Jew can, a deist can, and so forth. But I think that a Leninist communist excludes himself from the constitutional system, as does a Nazi or a fascist. After the Civil War, as does an aristocratic slaveholder, and as, I think, an Islamic jihadist would today. Now, who rejects this way of thinking, this account of how pluralism, guarded by the liberty of conscience, together with a shared constitutionalism, strikes the distinctive and original American balance between disagreement and agreement? Let me suggest three culprits. Those who think commonality is supplied by civil religion, those who think it's supplied by science, and those who think it's supplied by something they call public reason. Let me speak about these briefly in turn. Civic religion would be the position of those who reject what I said about the novus ordo and think that a homonoia, a like-mindedness, is still essential in any polity, an authoritative and comprehensive account of origins and ends cannot be done without. There are different versions of this, of course, or different candidates for a kind of American civic religion. Some see the story of America as a continuation of the Reformation and see America's rise to greatness as providential instruction based upon this. Others see it as a story of the rise of liberal individualism and progressivism. And some confuse the two together. I'm not saying that one is caught in the civic religion trap if one likes patriotic songs or takes pride in the flag or in elevating rhetoric. I don't mean that at all. But I mean that to be suspicious of something more earnest that makes those songs our only hymns, or rather sings only the first verses, not the second and third verses, which usually mention some higher power than the Constitution or America, or that treats a civic religion that treats the flag as a sacred object, not just as one to which we owe respect. If I'm right, then pluralism suggests that we actually have different favorite songs. To trivialize. Born in the USA for one party and proud to be an American for the other, right? And that we remember, more importantly, the differences between rhetoric and religion. The second culprit, I said, would be science. This was the trope of the progressives at the turn of the last century. Social and political division or partisanship or disagreement could be overcome by scientific fact. Someone referred to this a moment ago. These progressives claimed to be imitating the founders, who, after all, drew upon what was then a new and improved political science, even as they felt entitled to replace the founders, these progressives. Out with statesmanlike moderation, they thought, in with scientific expertise. The problem is not just that they are unfair to the founders' science, for they were actually serious about science, the founders. Think of Ben Franklin or Ben Rush or Tom Jefferson. But that they were naive about the extent and the character of scientific disagreement. On to public reason, then, quickly. This is an idea developed and promoted by John Rawls in his later works, and it's what lies behind political correctness and acquiescence in a hegemonic Supreme Court. Rawls claims to respect a pluralism of comprehensive doctrines among the people, but insists that in political life, we're allowed to bring to debate only such ideas as everyone can agree upon, whatever else we hold to be true. And then what happens is that, to no surprise, all that's allowed are the common opinions of secular liberalism, not those brought to public debate by religious believers. He makes an exception, of course, for the abolitionists and advocates of civil rights because he says, obviously, their views could also be defended on secular grounds. Others have shown better than I that what Rawls presents as neutral is altogether partisan. His defense of abortion rights in a footnote as a necessary conclusion of public reason would be comical if the result weren't tragic. But the upshot of his theory is the removal of fundamental questions from representative institutions and their deposit in what he calls the exemplar of public reason, the Supreme Court. I almost said that it would be demagogic. In an Ivy League educated Supreme Court. Rawls taught at Harvard, as you know. He's not wrong, Rawls, about overlapping consensus and the difference between comprehensive creeds and political compromise, I think. But he is wrong, I think, to hold that our constitutional institutions in their whole array are inadequate in themselves to the task of finding real consensus and need to be replaced by censorious professors and their A students wearing robes. Well, where does that leave us? Well, I hope it leaves us respectful of the role of rhetoric in political deliberation, in forensic debate, as well as in moments of ceremonial praise, that it leaves us tolerant of the inevitable disagreement in a free society, though not so tolerant that one is afraid to disagree when one encounters error. And finally, that it leaves us mindful of the human imperative to seek truth and appreciate and appreciative of a constitution that both provokes this quest and protects it. Thank you.